Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Top 100 fans. I want to play a game. By the end of this promo, you're going to have to choose between drinking mediocre hot beverages and drinking the very best hot beverages. The product before you? Sparkplug Coffee. They offer the freshest premium Arabica beans. Unlike the way many of you have lived your lives, Sparkplug's trade has always been fair, whether it's decaf, half-calf, or any kind of blend. You'll get your custom roasted coffee within a week, but I caution you that the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club is not part of some coffee of the month. It's personalized. A one-time 20% discount applies if you use the code TOP100PROJECT. So make your choice. But you should know when SparkplugCoffee.com is part of the equation, there is no other choice. Game over.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
In action.
Happy near the end of October, movie maniacs, and thanks a whole lot for affixing your oral canals to the next 169 project, the weekly look back at classic films of yesteryear. We started our podcasting careers by talking about the 123 titles on the AFI's 1998 and 2007 lists of rip-rockinist American flicks. They're all online, and they're free. Our mission now is to watch stuff that will make for a marvelous discussion. Caution, though. You better watch this movie first if you don't want it or the sequels spoiled. I'm the kidnapper in a pig mask with a slow-acting poison coursing through his veins. Very conveniently, coursing through his veins slowly, Ryan Ellis. And here's the proud owner of a puppet on a tricycle who would cut right through her ankle to save her dog's silly little lives, my wife Bev.
That's me.
They're not silly.
Plus, my name is Tilly, not silly. All right, the coming attractions trivia for this week's entry, the last in Scary Movie Month, it is Saw. Who is the greatest horror movie director of all time? So, of course, this is actually a coming attractions opinion. I'm giving you 10 names. Maybe there's 5 or 6 other good ones. And again, a proviso, as I said last week, I'm not including people who've done one or maybe 2 films. These names have done, I think, at least 3, if not a whole lot of horror movies. So George Romero, Dario Argento, John Carpenter, Wes Craven, James Whale, Sam Raimi, Guillermo del Toro, David Cronenberg, Takashi Miike, or James Wan, who directed Saw.
So I'll say this just as somebody who is woefully uneducated when it comes to deep niche horror, but just my personal opinion, I say del Toro.
Oh, interesting choice. He's done, let's see, Kronos and Pan's Labyrinth is horror in a lot of ways, and Crimson Peak a few years ago, and more than that, right?
Devil's Backbone.
Yeah, that was horror, I guess, too, isn't it? Definitely the most stylish. Well, maybe not the most, but one of the most stylish.
Maybe not the scariest, directors. Not by a long shot.
I picked 5. I did a little top 5 there, because I think all those guys are great choices. I went with Wes Craven, number 1. I guess we talked about that on Nightmare on Elm Street a few weeks ago. Just because he's done 4 different landmark horror films, and one of them became, well, 2 of them actually became franchises, but one he kept directing. So first he does Last House on the Left. And that was remade, and he was involved as a producer for that matter. Hills Have Eyes. Then he did Nightmare on Elm Street, and then he was involved in some of the sequels, even though he disowned a lot of the sequels. And of course, Scream. All 4 of those, which spun off a TV series. That's impressive to have done 3. Because you could talk about Sam Raimi, and I didn't put him in my top 5. Evil Dead is landmark. But he didn't really do a lot of other horror, other than maybe Drag Me to Hell, that stands out the same kind of way.
Wes Craven is a true horror director. That is his genre that he works in. Whale.
The Frankenstein films.
Yeah.
And Invisible Man, too. You can't forget that.
We've kind of outgrown it now, but he really did give us our iconic images of classic horror characters like Dracula, the Invisible Man.
He didn't do Dracula. It was Todd Browning. Todd Browning was somebody I thought about putting in this top 10 because he did Dracula, and he did, I think, one other big one. But then, of course, Freaks. But I didn't include him. He's certainly somebody you could mention, too. That's why I say other people might have another 10 names that I didn't even include. So I say Craven's number 1. Romero, I put in there for sure. The zombie movies. Also the Crazies way back when, the original Crazies. And then he did something else. Well, Monkey Shines, I believe he directed that. For All of Its Faults is a horror film of note, I guess. John Carpenter, not just Halloween, but The Fog. I don't think I talked about that quite a few weeks ago when I mentioned his name. And I'm forgetting everything else now. The Thing is kind of horror. He's done plenty of horror, actually. Prince of Darkness. Cronenberg, horror-ish, but certainly The Fly counts. Then again, you got to talk about his early films, like Rabbit and Shivers and those kinds of things. And then he had horror elements in a lot of his movies, like History of Violence has some horror in it, even though it's not a horror film. And I say James Wan. I think because, again, like Craven, so my number one and my number five are the same kind of thing. Even if their films aren't as great as some of the greatest horror films of all time, James Wan directed this. He directed a couple of the Insidious movies. He directed a couple of the, I guess, all of the Conjuring films. And he's been involved as a producer in a lot of them. So, wow. Again, you're talking about multiple different series. And in his case, and I guess that's true about Craven, too, original. So, wow, that's something else.
So, I love art house horror, but I don't really get into these popcorn horror films. Would you say that James Wan has gotten better as a director with, like, a budget?
I didn't love Aquaman, but I saw it last year. Not that that's horror.
The Conjuring
films. Well, I'm
films.
Just trying to piece through as I say that. I don't love his work, to be honest with you. Saw was not necessarily the most logical choice for this spot because we'll get into the influence of it, but it's not that scary. Blair Witch was something we talked about doing in the slot, and I was looking last night at movies from 2009. Paranormal Activity would have been a very good choice for this.
Yeah.
But we chose Saw partly because we wanted to get into a non-white male director, so this guy at least is not white. He was born in Malaysia, and we'll do some more women before the year's over, but we've done so many men lately, I thought we'll do a non-white director, and that's why we went with Wan. But then you look at his career, and it's pretty impressive. Are the movies better? I don't know if I love any of his films, but I certainly respect what he did in Insidious. Insidious has some pretty damn good scares in it. I've watched that part where the, what they even call him, I forget now, the big horror villain in that franchise, is behind Patrick Wilson's head, and there's that big music stinger. Got me in the theater. And seeing it more and more now is like the big hedge clipper scene, big scissors actually, in Exorcist 3. I've seen it so many times it doesn't scare me, but it sure did for a long time. So it's more of a respect thing to include him in this, I guess, in a way. But that's just something else, much like Craven, to have so many different series he's been a part of, and the director of as well, not just a producer or writer or something like that. And with respect to Ari Aster, Jordan Peele, Jennifer Kent, and many others who are new on the scene, who've only made one or two horror films, they could be on this list if we did it again in 3 or 4 years very easily. If Jordan Peele, especially, keeps doing these original, interesting, out there, don't see it coming horror movies with so much depth. And Ari Aster, for sure, too. We haven't seen Jennifer Kent's new movie, but we will one of these days. Okay, then. So, Puzzle Mortal, which is what it was called in Romania, Saw, was released by Lionsgate and Twisted Pictures. Twisted Pictures, I think, was new on the scene back then. It may have been created for this movie. I should look that up. 15 years ago, on October 29th, 2004, for the pocket money it cost, Saw earned a very nice chunk for the bigwigs. And it was supposed to go straight to video. And this series became a pretty big hit in the theater. I saw at least three of them, if not, well, I saw this one, so I saw at least three more, maybe even four more, on the big screen every year with two young ladies. They were 25-ish. I don't know how I even found out that they were into these, but Christina and Ella, the three of us, went every year for, I think, 3 years in a row. And I haven't seen those two in a long time, but it was our thing to watch the new Saw movie at the end of October, or middle of October, whatever, every single year. And it was probably the 4, 5, 6, that era, those sequels. All right, Bev, the movie is 15 years old, so explain what it's about to the fans with the skinny, for those who've forgotten what Saw is about.
Lee Whannell and Carrie Elwes are Adam and Larry, two men who mysteriously find themselves chained up on opposite ends of a filthy basement bathroom that they share with a corpse and a smattering of clues that slowly reveal that they've been kidnapped by a twisted killer named Jigsaw, who, in an effort to get people to appreciate life, murders them. Larry finally embraces life by sawing off his own foot to escape, leaving Adam behind.
I was looking up second-degree murder, incidentally, thinking that's what he was, and my skinny was going to include that phrase, second-degree murderer. But apparently, second-degree murders, you didn't premeditate. But this is so premeditated that obviously...
Yeah, I can't believe you thought for a second that this would not be...
But Carrie Elwes does say in the movie, and maybe his character's wrong, or Lee Whannell is one of the writers, and James Wan, who co-wrote or has a story credit at least... We're just wrong in saying this, but Elwes' character does say, as Lawrence Gordon, he's not technically a murderer. And he's not in the usual ways like Freddy Krueger or the Texas Chainsaw characters.
Charles Manson isn't technically
right.
a murderer.
That's true. Makes for an interesting villain, though, because I don't think that Jigsaw in any of the movies ever directly kills anyone. I can't think of right now. Definitely not in this movie.
I feel like
but
if you devise something that
if
kills
he was caught,
somebody,
he would
if
go
you
to jail.
Engineer a face trap or a skull screwdriver thing... that's going to kill people, then you're a murderer.
Yeah.
You would kidnap them and put them in this device and wait for it to kill them. That's murder.
He's also a judgmental prick. Or in a nutshell, underwear-clad death enabler lays unmoving on a dirty floor for about 7.5 hours.
Truly, that is something else.
I was looking at the clock the first time that they notice it. It's 10:30-ish, I guess, in the morning. I think it's supposed to be in the morning. Maybe it's the evening. Maybe it isn't actually accurate to the real time. Maybe they just made up their own time. Jigsaw and... his buddy Zepp, Zup, as they call it around the hospital. But it does say 10:30, and then the end of the movie is around 6, because if Dr. Gordon doesn't kill Adam by 6, then his family dies. That is the ticking clock element of this film. So the critical numbers are not very good from the people that actually review movies, the critics, but the audience has loved it. 49, probably one of our worst ever Rotten Tomatoes critical number. 91 fresh, 93 rotten, for an average of 5.5 out of 10. So I guess those who liked it pretty well, to put it over 50% for the 5.5, but being 49%, you know what I'm saying? But 84% of audiences, truly an audience movie. None of the Saw flicks got a fresh tomato, though, in fact. This was the closest at 49. Some of them really were in the toilet, in fact. I think that's probably because they became, what this movie's known for, torture porn. It was about seeing blood and guts. It was about seeing the saw go right through the ankle. Even though in this movie, you just see the beginning of that saw go through the ankle, and never again do you see any kind of cut.
He couldn't afford it. That's what that comes down to.
I think maybe James Wan, who didn't direct any of the sequels, showed restraint, too. Yeah, it's probably budget, but it's also restraint, and the sequels didn't have the restraint.
I think about, and this is a movie that came out after Saw, but I think about the way that they handled this in 127 hours, which I wouldn't say is a gory film. You have two movies that really are focused on, ultimately, a person voluntarily cutting their own limb off. It's like Chekhov's gun. When you see those saws there and you understand what has to happen, the movie is called Saw, and the poster has a severed hand. You know someone's sawing off a foot. There was a point, because this is my first time watching it, there was a point where it seemed like it was wrapping up, and I was like, well, no one's getting out of here without sawing off a foot. It makes sense, of course, that it would be Larry. He is the surgeon, and he's far more motivated to get out and save his family.
Never thinks to cut through those pipes, though. Maybe, even if you just cut a hole in that pipe big enough with the saw, it would probably not work to get all the way through it. Then you could start banging at it with your foot. Don't even try that, huh?
They have 7 hours, as you said, to make other attempts to get out of there. Pick a lock. There's just got to be other things you can do other than sit there and gripe. I wish if they had just shown Larry's face as he's cutting his own foot off. I wish it had been something that had been a little better illustrated. Now, part of this boils down to the fact that Cary Elwes phoned it in to the nth degree.
Oh, I don't think that's true. I think he tried too hard sometimes.
Well, then fine. Okay, maybe Danny Glover phoned it in.
He was only
Cary
on set.
Cary Elwes overdid it.
Glover was on set for about 2 days. And I like this movie is all about red herrings. And he's a big red herring because this is the Lethal Weapon guy. He's a heroic character, even though he played a villain himself in the 80s, in the same year, in fact. Great in The Color Purple, and then also that same year in Witness as a vicious villain. But he was way more known for being the heroic, nice guy cop in Lethal Weapon, and here's a cop again. So, of course, he's going to save the day. But instead, even though he lasts till almost the end of the movie, he doesn't save any kind of day. Just like his partner, Ken Leung, is that how you say his name? From Lost, just like Michael Emerson. Also another red herring as the actual villain. Both of them were on Lost years later. Lost started around the time this movie came out, around a month before Lost went on the air. But neither of them were on the show for a few years, in fact, as it turns out. But anyway, the red herring with Danny Glover, he's going to be either a villain, maybe, or he's going to be the hero of the whole thing. But he's not there at the end at all because of the various twists and turns. And yes, there's a lot of holes we can pick, and we will pick them as we go through, including trying something else other than cutting your own damn foot off. 57th is what this movie was at the 2004 U.S. box office. Saw 2 was the biggest hit, and Saw 3 was close behind. Then they started going downhill. But considering these movies always cost very little, I think all of them, certainly most of them, did pretty well. I guess Saw 3D didn't do all that well because they stopped making them. That one was clearly shot, as they all were, actually. All the sequels, not this one, but all the sequels were shot in Toronto. And if you're any kind of resident of the city and know downtown, you know that they shot the opening sequence of Saw 3D above Metro Hall, on the street level of Metro Hall. I've walked past where they shot that thousands of dimes, probably, in my life. And it's not even all that well hidden. Obviously, they do their own set dressing and whatnot, but this became a Toronto series. This movie, though, was mostly shot on sound stages, including the car chase between Glover and Michael Emerson towards the end. They're just in some garage. I think apparently the same warehouse where this movie was shot almost entirely. So the various apartments and the police stations, certainly the bathroom set, were in this one place. They kept redressing it. They found other elements where they were going to shoot stuff. Reservoir Dogs did that. The main location, but above that is where they had Mr. Orange's apartment. This did the same thing to the nth degree. I think even maybe Jigsaw's workshop was in that same location. So I'm not sure if it was the exact same garage, but the idea was we'll just move our lights around. And of course, like they do so much in this movie, the camera zips around. Very fast editing. And by the way, you said about Saw and the multiple meanings of this, and there are multiple meanings in this title. Of course, the jigsaw piece that he cuts into his victims. Then, of course, the hacksaw to cut off their own feet or something else, like a pipe. And then also, I think the logic of, can you see the clues? Are you able to see, saw, the clues? All right, well, anyway, after all this, I should ask you, and I know the answer to this. What do you think of our last scary movie in Scary Movie Month? Good tension, maybe more so than scares.
Yeah, I've done nothing but disappoint you this month. I resisted seeing Saw when it came out because there was just a little about the concept that I found appealing. And it turns out that 15 years later, I was right. I could have skipped this one. I really liked the puzzle aspect, and the stuff in the room is pretty good. Good enough that it makes the flashbacks really stick out in comparison. I wish it had taken a note from movies like Cube or Phone Booth and just make a bottle episode movie. Take all that money you spent on Danny Glover and spend it on actually showing us that foot getting severed. At any rate, I finally know why most escape rooms are styled to look like damp, filthy basements.
Because you think the escape room thing that we certainly have done many times and many people do all the time is modeled after this film. And dude, apparently escape rooms started in 2007.
Yeah, that's obviously true, right? Because we've done our share of escape rooms, and they're all similar to the puzzles. They don't do that many puzzles, really, in Saw. There's only a handful of them. But that notion of giving you clues, and you're in a room, and the glow-in-the-dark excess in every escape room.
The ticking clock.
Ticking clock, yeah. These are such common elements of escape rooms.
And we've done a horror one.
And it was amazing. It was terrifying, in the best way.
Yes, fun.
But we've done four escape rooms, and three out of the four of them were in underlit dark basements. Damp, miserable looking, just like Saw. But you can't tell me that it's not inspired by this.
The bathroom is not underlit.
No, that's true. It's not underlit.
It's overlit. There's fluorescence just blazing away.
The aesthetic of a filthy basement
bathroom. Oh, that's true. It's very filthy.
It's really borrowed in a lot of escape
And rooms. I will do this a lot in this podcast, and here's another example of me skipping ahead to the future movies, which you haven't seen either. Definitely some spoilers here. We find out that this bathroom is part of Jigsaw's lair. I guess he bought some warehouse. I think it's supposed to be that his wife, who we obviously don't know anything about in this movie, but his wife in the future movies, Jill, is wealthy. And I think he was maybe wealthy too. But anyway, he's got the kind of money where he can own this big warehouse and then have these guys in this bathroom. Because the bathroom comes back in 2, and I think it comes back in 3, and I think it definitely comes back in Saw 3D. Because Cary Elwes, who wasn't in any of the sequels until Saw 3D, appears at the very end. And as retconned, as a lot of things in this series are, he ends up helping out Jigsaw. It's like he's been converted. Because what they also show in one of the sequels, I forget which one it is now, John, I think before cancer, or maybe it's after he's been diagnosed with cancer, but he's still relatively healthy looking, gets in a car accident, and he's got rebar or something right through him, and he has to pull it out of himself. It's almost like, my will to live is so strong. Is your will to live as strong as mine is? Well, fuck you!
I know, fuck you! Get out of here!
And we also learn why he hates drug addicts so much, because Amanda, and we also see a lot of Shawnee Smith in the sequel, she's a big part of 2, she's in 3, big part of that too, and I think she's in Saw 6, is it? So she ends up being an apprentice of his, and we learn that Larry Gordon was a helper of his all the way through. And then the main villain in so many of the movies ends up being this detective who's got nothing to do with this film whatsoever. I think not even the second or even third movie, I think it's the fourth maybe, he finally comes in. But somewhere in there, he comes in the picture. So all these people are working with Jigsaw, who dies at the end of 3 because the brain cancer finally starts taking him and needs some help from a doctor. He brings her into the game. And that's actually interesting because they make it, I think it's Saw 3 and 4, the elaborateness of this guy's plan. Somebody dying of brain cancer, even with help. A couple of the movies coalesce and you find out this movie happened while that movie was happening at the same time and they meet. But anyway, he dies at the very end. He's going to die of brain cancer anyway. But one of the characters, again, not in this movie, cuts his throat and then he's finally just dead. But he's always in all the sequels, 4, 5, 6, I guess it's 3D is 7, in flashbacks. But Larry ends up being a big part of things because he's a surgeon. You look at things and you think, oh, okay, that's how they could sew somebody's eye shut. And there's a key under somebody's eye because it's a surgeon that did that. And that is pretty gory. I dispute that this is torture porn, because you don't see that much. And you could say it's the budget thing and not showing the ankle get cut off. I think it is restraint. What really popularized torture porn were the sequels of this series, and they came out every single year, 2005, 2006, and 7, and so on. But it was more so Hostel, which was a couple years after this, where Eli Roth, who I like for the most part, I don't love his movies, like him as a speaker. He's a very smart, interesting, funny guy. His movie was gory, but I was looking at some of the other movies you could call torture porn, which existed long before this series ever even started.
Well, I always think of the remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. That came out before Saw.
The year before this did.
That is, like, by definition, a torture porn film.
Okay, right. And all the Texas Chainsaw sequels and the prequel would blatantly show you chainsaws going into bodies. Like we said on that podcast a few weeks ago, the only chainsaw you ever see going to a body is when Leatherface at the very end accidentally drops it on his own leg. They didn't make it all that gory, but the sequels and prequel on Texas Chainsaw are very much so, just like the Saw movies. But anyway, I'm going way beyond that. Last House on the Left. I'm not talking about the one from 2009. Monica Potter, who is the wife in this, she's Allison, The last movie she ever made 10 years ago was The Last House on the Left remake, where she's the mother in that movie. But the original one I'm talking about, way more gory. They pull out a girl's guts in that original movie that Wes Craven, I mentioned him earlier, did. Cannibal Holocaust, where they get incredibly gory. Saw is just like all the best horror films. You think you're seeing so much, and you're really not in the end. It's like those people that say, or that woman that said in Seven, I hated that movie because I saw the head in the box. You never even saw blood in that box. You think you did, and Saw is the same damn thing.
I totally agree. I'm not sure how this film ever got classified as torture porn. It doesn't really show violence. It shows people upset trying to get out of their situations, but it's as much torture porn as Seven is, which is a movie that's as much about torture, but it doesn't really illustrate torture.
We see the aftermath. That movie's always about aftermath, except when Kevin Spacey gets shot in the head. Even that's not gory, because the camera pulls way back, almost seems like a mile back, when Pitt shoots him in the head. So you don't see any brains going anywhere, not up close at least.
Yeah.
That movie's about aftermaths, and this one's about a lot of times during type stuff. I can see why the squeamish wouldn't want to watch something like this. The big fat dude who has to get through the wires, the suggestion of that, and what you do see, it's not exactly fun. It's not a Disney movie, but it isn't as gory as the sequels.
Somehow it doesn't bother me nearly as much as the descriptions of the things that happen in Seven. If it's trying to go for that as its selling point, is trying to appeal to people who are titillated by violence, then it does a really poor job. It does a great job of setting up the aspect of trying to escape, trying to use your wits to escape a situation. I wish that that took up more than half the movie. Really ends up being them trying to sort out what's happening and find a way out. I don't know how you would categorize... Well, actually, I do know how you would categorize the stuff with the cops, which is filler that seemed to come from a cliche generator in the brain of somebody who's watched every single episode of CSI and Law and Order.
I think that's
and,
the point.
Yeah,
They're going to be the heroes. And then Ken Leong is dead about midway through. Again, the sequels would have absolutely shown him getting his brain splattered everywhere and those, what is it, four guns that shoot at him?
Mm-hmm.
Although we learn in that scene that Jigsaw's bulletproof because he blatantly gets shot and goes down and he's a cancer patient and he's not a young man. And he seems to live on for many days and weeks and months afterwards.
Like most horror villains, certain bulletproofness.
And Sing is dead so early on in the story. Ken Leong and Danny Glover's character, Tap, who lives a lot longer, ends up being offed before we get to the end, too. So let's go back to the beginning of the story, the way it starts. So the very first shot is of Adam in the bathtub, how the hell he didn't drown when he's knocked out in the tub,
right?
Breathing water.
He's unconscious and he's underwater. We don't know how long he's been like that, but... What a dangerous thing. If your goal is to make them suffer and make them try to figure out a way out, well, put him in a situation where he's likely to die right away. What do you do then, Jigsaw?
And also the key floats past him. CinemaSins shows that shot and points out, is this a key? It's glowing blue. You don't really know it's a key until the very end of the film or watching it more than once. Because Jigsaw says at the end, the key to those cuffs are in that bathtub. Except if the key hadn't floated down in the bathtub, then Adam could have got out immediately.
Yeah.
And then what?
Yeah.
But, again, retconned, we see Amanda, who is a vindictive bitch. She helps Jigsaw, and even in this movie, she says, he helped me. So, they set that up nicely. They probably didn't know they'd ever have sequels from this movie. But she ends up being the apprentice who's also not playing fair. She makes more than one trap where the person can't get out. And Jigsaw's whole thing, his whole plan is, you can always get out. You're going to lose something, maybe a body part, or you're going to lose a lot of blood, or you're going
to
suffer.
You have to kill somebody else.
Maybe you have to kill somebody else. Yeah, that's one of the
Which
things.
Which is what that, she you know. Does. Without hesitation.
But anyway, we see in one of the sequels that it's shown she is setting up the bathtub and she is supposed to put the key in his pocket, but instead she just puts it on his body knowing it'll wash down the drain. But John doesn't see that because he's putting the makeup on his head and about to lay down face first in the bathroom. There is the biggest question in this whole movie, which I remember thinking when I saw it, let alone when I talked about it with people later on, or even just saw it again or thought back on it, was how did this cancer patient lay there for 7.5 hours, never twitch, not breathe. I think they say in the retcon in the sequels where he took a pill so he slows his heart rate down. But he still has to breathe. Sometime.
And you have to fake it, not just for two people who have nothing else to look at for 7 hours. One of them happens to be a surgeon. Who knows the difference between a living body and a corpse?
And I remember talking about this with a teacher of mine who actually liked this movie a lot. One of the reasons I wanted to cover this movie is I remember talking with him for about 40 minutes about this film. I had already seen it, thought it was fine, not great, but I was intrigued by it. I wasn't really scared by it, of course. The biggest scares are things that are, I guess, universal, being kidnapped, the pig mask scenes, Michael Emerson doing what he's doing. Those are pretty effective when he's in Diana's bedroom, the kid, And he's in the closet because Michael Emerson has big eyes and he can be weird looking. And you think for a long time he's actually the villain. Those are fairly scary. The movie in general is not. But anyway, this teacher and I were talking about it for a while, this mentor of mine. And he found so much depth to this movie, and I ended up seeing it that way as well. That's what made me feel intrigued by it more than actually scared by it. But it's stuff like that where we definitely agreed. He and I said, how does this guy lay there? I remember saying to him, he never giggles. My plan's working. Hey, this is great.
Nobody coughs.
Because retcon, he
has to go to this bathroom.
Well, okay, yes, true, yeah. But it's retcon later on that this is not his first trap. Well, we know it's not his first even this movie because he has the heavyset dude who has to get through the wire. So, okay, fine, there's that. But he's new-ish at this, at that point at least. And he's never giggling like, oh, this is great. This is working out. Oh, man, this is so cool. But also we learn later that Adam and Larry can be zapped, and they both are zapped. I don't know how exactly that works. That's on the goose section.
Zap's like watching.
No, I mean literally how you... There's no ground. You wouldn't be able to zap them, I guess, is what people are saying.
Okay.
But okay, I'll cut them the slack that you can't literally do it and just say, okay, somebody did do it. Zap definitely does it, or could have at least done it once, to Adam. But when it happens to Larry... Zep is not in the room anymore. So that means that John had to do it. Although we learn later on there's other apprentices. So maybe you could argue they did it. But just based on this movie, it has to be John, Jigsaw, laying face down. And his hands are both exposed. One's got the tape recorder and one's got the gun.
I mean, Hollywood loves an impossibly elaborate murder scheme.
And this definitely has that. Well, certainly the sequels do too.
So you were talking about the scenes where they get kidnapped, which are arguably the scariest scenes in the movie. But that does make me need to point out what I think is a huge missed opportunity, but also one of my biggest problems with the film, which is mostly that it's, I don't think the right word is sloppy, but more like there's an amateurness about it.
They were new filmmakers,
but I'm going to talk about the scene where Adam gets kidnapped, where he's in his apartment, he's in a dark room, there's a red light, of course. Cinematography in this film, not great. The whole look is kind of ugly and does look very cheap and amateurish.
I won't see you slandering David Armstrong, who shot the first six movies in the series.
Well,
I won't have it.
Listen, money goes a long way with a lot of these things.
You will have it.
Okay, good.
Grimy fits.
Terrible.
But grimy fits the motif.
No, I'm not talking about grimy. I'm talking about how it looks like a film set. The apartment where Cary Elwes is meeting his lover that he ends up not having an affair with. The lighting looks like an SNL set. But anyway, I'm going to talk about when Adam gets kidnapped and it's pitch black dark. Not so dark, though, that I, the audience, wouldn't spot a man anywhere in that room. I think back to a movie like Hereditary, a film that plays with the dark so adeptly. Or something like Silence of the Lambs, which shows the audience the room but convincingly conveys that our hero was totally blind. Here you have a situation where he's supposed to be unable to see in the dark. How cool would it have looked if it was actually too dark for us to see and it was just illuminated with those camera flashes and then we had to just see what he saw? Like a lightning strike. It's actually like an old trick. I'm really surprised that they didn't think of this or correct it after the fact, because that's the kind of thing that you can actually correct after the fact pretty easily when you're color timing a film. And just their failure to do something that would have elevated that scene so much is, to me, an example of where maybe it's just not that inspired. That kind of thing is what was missing for me.
I get the criticism of it not being darker than it should have been, because one of the most memorable things in the movie the same year as this, it was only a few months before, Kill Bill Volume 2, when Uma Thurman is being buried alive and the screen is entirely black. Not for very long, but for a little while, it's fully black. And I think I talked about this on the podcast we did a few years ago for the Kill Bill films. When I saw that movie, and it was not a very big theater, so it didn't have a lot of that extra lighting you have. And I felt, in the right way, like I was trapped in a box
for
a few seconds.
So claustrophobic, you hear her breathing. I remember that too, really clearly being in the theater in that scene, the pitch black dark, and how that makes you feel, and how the audience will sit there for it, and they will just listen. Because if you are at all invested in the characters, then you're invested in their version of what's going on, which is pitch black dark and only you're hearing. Another great example of a bottle episode that takes advantage of limited space is, I'm pretty sure it's called Buried, that Ryan Reynolds film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The entire film takes place in a goddamn coffin. And they play with light and dark so well because
the
light
bit of
is
the coffin.
His lifeline.
Almost you don't leave that coffin, yeah. I think Don't Breathe from a couple years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Used darkness pretty well.
Yeah, absolutely.
But maybe that's the rookiness, or like it's the second film technically for James Wan. He did Stygian. There's a Stygian street or something like that in this movie. It's a reference to his very first film. He and Lee Whannell worked together a lot of times, in fact. Whannell wrote other things. He was in the Insidious movies in a more of a comic relief role. But Whannell's worked with Wan a few times, and they were just new to filmmaking. Then again, the lead character, and we look in the IMDb right now, it's not Cary Elwes. The credit list here is Winnell, then Elwes, then Glover, then Leung, and so on. Winnell, at least in this, is not a very good actor. I think he sells the horror of the foot being cut off and the very end of the movie pretty well. But when he's supposed to be poisoned by the cigarette, and I guess the idea is it's not a very good performance.
Well, he's acting as a bad actor.
And the character can be a bad actor, but I don't think the actor is capable of playing a bad actor. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
a good actor can play a bad actor, but Winnell's not good enough to pull that off. And yeah, he's got as much screen time as anybody in this movie. Maybe Elwes has more because of all the flashbacks. This movie is so heavy on flashbacks. Even 20 or so minutes in, we're starting getting flashbacks. But of course, some of that's because you see Shawnee Smith as Amanda telling her story about what happened to her in a bear trap. By the way, I've read this online, and it's fun to watch this. You have to freeze frame probably to notice it. But when we first see Jigsaw, when he's a cancer patient, we don't know it matters at all that he is. You see Larry's intern is part of that group of people. The intern's being told this patient has, I think it started in his colon, but now it's brain cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also see that's when Zepp comes in. He's very special. His name is John. We don't know he matters at that point either. The thing I want to bring up, though, is that apparently in front of John is a drawing of the bear trap that's going to go on Amanda later on and will be in future movies. It's what kills, another spoiler alert, Jigsaw's wife, Jill, in the last movie. And that's why the cop who becomes an apprentice and is a real badass motherfucker, he's an asshole. But Larry is brought back as insurance because, of course, Jigsaw's long dead. If this guy ever messes with Jill, you got to make sure he dies. And the very last shot of this series, at least so far, well, none, you know, they did Jigsaw a couple years ago, but that's a prequel. So the last shot proper of the original batch of movies, all they did one every single year, was Cary Elwes with one foot, of course, because he cut the other one off, throwing away a saw, and I think he says game over, when the cop, who was an apprentice for a lot of these movies, is the one who's trapped just like Adam is in this film. And I'm going to jump to the end of this movie and ask the question, why does Adam have to die? He has a sleazy job. He's not exactly an upright citizen. Nobody in this movie is. Everybody's very flawed, although Larry doesn't actually seem like he cheated on his wife. He insists he didn't. And when we see the scene with him and the intern, it seems like they're about to have an affair, but actually didn't ever do it.
The audience would be the only people who knew that he didn't go through with it. It's totally fair to assume that Jigsaw and Adam both thought while he was in that room they had sex.
And again, I come back to what I said before, which is fuck Jigsaw for being such a judgmental prick. This is none of your business.
It's not a capital offense.
To have an affair
with your intern. To have an affair with your intern. It's not a capital offense to be a sleazy photographer.
Yeah, it's not the greatest job in the world. It's like a PI. It's not the greatest job in the world when it comes to a moral standpoint, but Jesus Christ, he shouldn't have to be left in that room. And I guess maybe Jigsaw's saying the key to those cuffs are in that tub. Let's say the key was still in there somehow and he didn't somehow see it, which he would have. Okay, so he gets himself out, but then Jigsaw closes the fucking door. What's he supposed to do then? He's left to scream anyway. Now he's able to walk around the room, but he's still in that fucking room.
It's because Jigsaw's motivations are pretty thin. Clearly, he's just a sadist and a murderer, and he has this morality excuse that he's just trying to get people to appreciate life. That's why in The Skinny, I was like, he's making people appreciate life by murdering them.
Well, it's also against his MO, even in this movie, but certainly because I know the sequels pretty well. I rewatched them all. Not Jigsaw, I guess, the more recent one, but the other ones that were all on demand and for free. That's why I watched them. We had to pay for this, though. $5. Against my morality, I have to pay for it. But this one's not free on demand. But anyway, he doesn't ever put a wife and daughter in harm, though he does in this movie. And he's running a big risk because Zepp is desperate. He's got the slow-acting poison going through his veins. He has to trust that Zepp won't actually shoot the wife and daughter when it gets to be 6 o'clock, like he's told he has to do to save his own life. And it gets to be 6 o'clock, and Larry has not killed Adam. I don't know how supposedly John would have, I guess, risen up at that point had Larry actually killed Adam before, maybe. Would have said, okay, well, there you go. You won, so now you get out of here. I don't know what the exact logic is. But he's running a big risk, Jigsaw's, that this desperate guy, who's obviously morally bankrupt himself, Zepp, doesn't kill this completely innocent little girl and this innocent wife who had nothing to do with anything. They get away, thank God. We do see Allison and Diana with some neighbors and they're okay. And we never see them again. I don't think they're even referenced again, which is also one of the retcon things because Larry gets involved as an apprentice. But once he gets out of there, he's so desperate to save his wife and daughter, who he seems to love, certainly his daughter and even his wife. They're having problems, but he's not cheating, apparently. So he's going to be reborn like Amanda is, but he's still going to be helping out a murderer to do murdery things? I don't think I really buy that either.
Well, he can't be that great of a surgeon, and I say that because of the tourniquet that he makes. I use the word tourniquet loosely as that shirt is wrapped around his ankle to staunch the bleeding.
It's pointed out online that why didn't he try using his shirt to pull the phone closer when it's ringing?
I said that while we were watching the movie.
Right, you did that. Okay, you did that too. But he's the one that says to Adam, use your shirt to try to get the tape recorder. But I could argue he's not in his right mind. He's insane because he thinks that maybe his wife and daughter have just been hurt or even killed. So he's not thinking clearly.
Okay, fine.
But it is debatable anyway, because he's a suspect in this movie. Danny Glover's character thinks that he's the killer. But why would smart cops, and they seem like they are, Tap and Singh are not stupid, think that an oncologist would ever have time to plan and execute all these complicated traps? You need to have one job in your life, and that is to do this, to be Jigsaw. You can't be a doctor with a wife and daughter at home, and supposedly they all think he's having an affair, and still do all this?
Although...
Just because of a pen light?
Oh, yeah, that is...
That somebody could have stolen?
Yeah.
That obviously Zepp stole at some point, or maybe John did before he left the hospital when he was diagnosed with brain cancer?
But you know that the occupations with the highest rates of psychopaths... Surgeons is always way up there.
Really?
A lot of psychopaths become surgeons.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So I just have one note, and this is more about the writing than the acting, about Adam's character. And I used to be a smoker. I smoked for 15 years. And I know the specific agony of a nicotine. But you're gonna smoke a cigarette delivered in a velvet box by the same psycho who knocked you out and locked you in a room with a corpse? I've never had a Nick fit that bad.
Well, Lee Winnell did co-write this movie. Maybe he's not the greatest writer in the world. Better writer than actor. But yeah, that's a fair point. He doesn't see that Larry does prepare one of the cigarettes with blood, which I don't know, would that work? If somebody died of poison, who also put a bullet through their head, and interestingly, when Larry does get the gun later on, he doesn't look again. He's out of his mind because I think at that point he's already cut his own foot off.
Mm.
He's got to go save his family. He knows he's under a gun here. No pun intended, I guess. But there are no spent cartridges in that gun because, of course, John didn't actually shoot anybody. He pretended he shot his own
brains. There's no reason why either of those people would know what a gun looks like with spent cartridges, though.
But that's supposed to be poisoned blood that's scattered around there. So he dips the cigarette in the blood. But would that ever actually poison somebody smoking it?
And even if it could, would nobody look at this cigarette and go, maybe I won't smoke this cigarette that's covered in blood that also came... from a psycho killer in a velvet box.
It would have actually been a pretty good twist, because the very end of this movie is a great twist, that when he rises up at the end, when John does, and you realize, oh my god, the guy orchestrating all of this, it wasn't that Danny Glover's going to save everybody, or that he's somehow the villain. It wasn't Michael Emerson that's the villain. It wasn't somebody else altogether. It was the guy laying in front of them the whole time. Great moment, and it's also shot similarly to when Michael Myers rises up towards the end of Halloween. He's dead! And then she goes in the hallway and sits there for a minute, but then he does that little zombie sit-up thing that The Undertaker in wrestling has been doing for 25 years, exact same thing. But as he sits up, that great widescreen shot, similar to this, where John rises up. Because when you first see that shot, if you don't know what's coming, you think, why is it framed that way? Oh, they have to leave room for somebody to rise up. And of course, you flash back through everything, and they make it work in the moment. It doesn't hold together at all, because what we said before, he never breathes, he never fidgets, he never coughs. You mentioned about peeing. You could argue him peeing, they wouldn't necessarily notice, and their attention wouldn't always be on him, but he just runs the risk of ever moving. But it is a great twist, and then you go back through with the incredibly fast edits as well to show how he got to there. And we see Zepp mentioning him in the hospital a little bit, because you don't really see much at all of this killer through the entire movie until that ending sequence. We know, of course, that he's the one in the shop when the two cops have him dead to rights. You hear that voice, and when you know the movies the way I do, having seen them so many times, it's blatantly him. Michael Emerson sounds nothing like him. Although, I guess you could argue that if Michael Emerson was always the bad guy, that his voice was digitally altered on the tapes.
Yeah.
Or when we see Billy, the little puppet that comes out. Amanda, first time that's ever shown in any of these movies, Amanda's the one when she beats her trap. You said that was eerie. You like that moment when the tricycle comes out with a little puppet on it.
Yeah, that spooked me. Mm. It was scary. It's a common Halloween costume. It's a cool, scary face. I still was spooked by it on the tricycle and the way that was lit and just the audio and everything came together. The film is hardly a total failure. I think it's just that the ways that it does fail are the types of things that I cannot abide.
And at the very end, again, it's retcon where he walks out of the bathroom because he's not long after Larry crawling out of the bathroom, finds him, converts him to one of his followers, and then Adam just dies. We see him in two at the end. His body has been dissolving for a while now. When Amanda, just like the ultimate mastermind in this movie, starts out her part of that movie, it's number two, face down in the main room. And that is more of a true escape room, because it's in, I think it's supposed to be, yeah, it is. It's part of the same house, or big complex, or warehouse, whatever you want to call it. Jigsaw's prepared all of this for many months, I guess. He's a busy guy. He's pulling doubles every single day. But she and Donnie Wahlberg's kid end up in the bathroom with the baddest of the bad guys in that movie, and you see where the foot's still laying there, and you see Adam's decomposing body. But in the sequence when Jigsaw's dead to rights with the cops, and that guy with the drills coming at his head, you mentioned that before, he has no reason to wear a cloak and gloves while alone.
No.
That is entirely for our benefit, because otherwise we'd see that it is. Well, we wouldn't even know who he is. You're not paying attention to the guy laying in the bed. The one time you saw him before that was that scene where Larry's talking about a cancer patient. So what? It could just be an extra. At that point, it is an extra. But if we had seen him, then you know, of course, it's not Michael Emerson. Then you lose your fake out there. One of the many great red herrings.
Or even, like, covering all of his creations with tarps. One of those creations being a diorama of what he's going to do to Larry and Adam.
Not the scale. All...
What the hell is that?
In that sequence, though, these rogue cops who find Jigsaw without a warrant, just like in Nightmare on Elm Street, we talked about that a few weeks ago, John Kramer would walk. Because they can't go into his place without a warrant, so whatever they find there is inadmissible. And maybe there'd be some vigilante justice for Jigsaw like there was for Freddy. Warrant? Who needs a warrant? You're cops! This is what you have to do! It's part of your job!
Well, you said that Lee Whannell is a better writer than an actor, and I don't know if I agree with you. There's some pretty corny writing, especially in the flashback stuff. Especially the cops.
Yeah, they are pretty rote. But I think the idea is, let's just do what's been seen in hundreds, if not thousands, especially film noir. Because I've seen so much film noir in my life, way more than you, way more than most people probably, and quite a few lately. It's one of those things on YouTube. You want to find an hour and 10-minute movie, you have an hour and 20 minutes to kill, and you need something shorter than a typical movie length. There's a lot of film noir on YouTube. But they are cliche. They talk like you think they're going to talk from that era, and they do what you think they're going to do from that era. So maybe that's the idea. We'll set up these two guys, one of whom is a famous actor, and especially playing a cop, and then we pull the rug out from under you. One cop we do see briefly who becomes a bigger part of the sequels, and she's definitely on my, as they say in Friends, remember the laminated list that David Schwimmer, Ross has, I should say. And then he takes off Isabella Rossellini with his laminated list, but then he meets her. My name is on this list. Dina Meyer, 2004 era, and of course her good little run on Friends as well, when she's with Joey. Sorry to say, but she's on my laminated list.
You don't have to be sorry, that's all right.
Go back in time. She is a babe. And she becomes an important player. But I said before, Amanda, when she is an apprentice and doesn't play by Jigsaw's rules, doesn't give people a chance, Dina Meyer, Carrie, dies in 3 or 4, whichever one it is. She has no chance to get out of the trap that she's in, and she gets her ribs pulled out of her body.
Oh, God.
Like I say, extraordinarily graphic.
See, that's why I don't watch these movies. I just get nothing from
the sequels
stuff like that.
Are fun, especially when they tie together things, especially when they have movies running concurrently, and I don't know how you can be that good at all this stuff. But they are overly gory. I don't mind that, but I can see why you wouldn't want to see that.
We talked about this when we covered 7. Even with resources, even with time, even with a genius intellect, it would still take such a tremendous amount of luck for him to have pulled off the murders that he pulled off in the order, everything going perfectly, and then the assumptions that Brad Pitt would shoot him in the head at the end. There's just way too much luck going on, no matter how perfect he planned these things. But it's a good enough movie that you just suspend your disbelief. The point of this movie isn't necessarily realism, and it's the same with Saw. Like, I don't need it to feel hyper-realistic. If it's a good enough film, I forgive the fact that Jigsaw never actually could pull his stuff off.
You know what's funny is the 4 movies we cover for Scary Movie Month, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Nightmare on Elm Street, Interview with the Vampire, and now this, that the most realistic is probably the first one.
Yeah.
And that's Texas Chainsaw. This is realistic because somebody could do these things. It's not supernatural. It's not some ghost in the grave haunting you in your dreams. It's not a vampire. Saw could happen, except when you think about how perfect everything has to go to make this work, including not breathing when you're laying face down on a bathroom floor. That's what's a little supernatural about this. But yeah, the Texas Chainsaw thing could happen.
Not even unrealistic, really, Texas Chainsaw.
Now, we learn later on that John is married, and why he's so mad at the drug addict in whichever one of the sequels it is, that accidentally kills his wife's baby. She's very pregnant. She's a doctor. It's a drug clinic. The guy pushes open a door, hurts her, and then she has a miscarriage. So that's one of the reasons why he's so mad. And he's pissed off at people that give up their will to live. That's why his real problem with anybody who tried to kill themselves or is a drug addict. I want my baby back, and I would love to have my life. I'm not going to have much longer. And I survived a car wreck. What the fuck is wrong with you? I get the judgment part of it, and you could just argue, well, if I can get the judgment part of it, well, then all it takes is a little bit of a push, as the Joker would say, that you could go into the level of wanting to hurt people and punish them. And in his mind, they could all survive their traps, the ones he sets. But I just come back to the same point I probably made more than once here, which is, what the fuck are you? And in this movie, yeah. a guy who's a sleazy photographer, but that's a job. People could hire for that kind of job. He's a private investigator, effectively.
We don't actually see him doing anything bad to anybody.
He's the one that takes shots of Larry when he leaves the hotel. Fine, he didn't even have an affair.
It's a job. Sorry to say. Maybe a little bit
sleazy. And a cop hired him to do it.
Yeah, exactly. Cops do that shit all the time, and they're supposed to be heroes. I will cite another David Fincher film and talk about that moment in Fight Club when Edward Norton and Brad Pitt kidnap a guy from the convenience store, mm-hmm. bully him into going and becoming a vet like he really wanted to. Tomorrow his breakfast is going to taste like the best thing he's ever eaten in his life. Well, you clearly don't know the first thing about how trauma affects people, yeah. because actually, trauma makes people want to live less, or it spoils the life that they're experiencing. This isn't an effective way to get people to appreciate their lives.
And also, be a vet, or we're going to come back, or I, as it turns out in that movie, will come back and kill you. Fuck off!
I know! Listen, vet school's expensive. This guy works at a convenience store. How the hell is he going to pay for it?
And the difference in that movie is that he's not hurting anybody. Jigsaw, again, we're talking more about the sequels, picks people that are often doing some pretty terrible things. One of the sequels is all about people who combined to fuck over, I think it's that bad cop I talked about in the sequels, Costas Mandalore, that's the guy who plays him. Hoffman, because one of the producers on this is Hoffman, I think his name is Hoffman as a character. Anyway, his sister or something like that, she suffered somehow, killed herself, whatever it was, died. And the people that get picked in one of the many sequels, five, I think it might be, five of them, whatever it is, were all involved one way or another. Somebody was a politician, maybe. Somebody was the person that authorized this building to be built, not to code, something like that. And then they all are part of this, so you'll all pay for that. That I get a little bit more than what happens to these guys in this film. So maybe when you watch all of them, it actually hurts this one. Because if this movie was a standalone film, it actually might be better. So what do you think of Elway? Since we talked about Winnell not being very good, especially since he's basically the lead of the film. And even the other people. I think Tobin Bell, but you didn't see him as much as you would in the sequels. He's a bigger part of that.
He's not in this for very much.
Great voice, of course, which I think they digitally manipulated. And we did that with my intro in this. That was my voice that Bev fixed digitally. This coffee sponsor.
Podcast magic.
But Elway's, who's so much fun in Princess Bride and Days of Thunder, not so much Days of Thunder maybe, but we've covered him on this channel in those movies. Princess Bride, he's so roguish and charming. Days of Thunder, smaller role. What do you think of the actors in this movie?
With the exception of Lee Winnell, I think everybody who got cast in this film was probably pretty convinced that it was going to go nowhere and be seen by nobody, and didn't really try that hard. A lot of low-budget films, this is what happens when you have a mediocre script and no rehearsal time and a director who doesn't really know what to do with them. And maybe Cary Elwes is a great example of one of those actors that when he's in the right hands, good director.
Rob Reiner,
exactly. Excellent. He can get exactly what he needs out of him. But when you're in the hands of somebody who doesn't really know what they're doing and doesn't have the time to do trial and error.
Nightmare on Elm Street problem all over again.
Budget. Yeah. Sometimes you see directors make terrible films with small budgets, but then really show their talent when they make a bigger film with a proper budget and they have the time and the resources to do what they want.
To do take three and four, not just one and two.
Sometimes it's just as simple as take three and four. Sometimes it's as simple as spending a week in rehearsals. Sometimes these movies don't even get a table read and they just have to go out and they need to shoot and they don't have time for a second take. So that's got to be part of it too. But whatever is at fault for these actors that have all been great in other things, with the exception of Lee Winnell. Some of them are better than others. I actually think Michael Emerson is great in Saw. I think he does a really good
job.
Very
similar to his character in Ben, in some ways at least.
Yeah, but it's very convincing. He's a very authentic actor. He knows how to look very natural, no matter what he's doing, even if he's doing something completely ridiculous. He's always a very authentic and believable actor, and he pulls it off here. But everybody else bites it, especially Danny Glover. Oh my God, I'm so embarrassed for him.
Well, he shot a couple of days, so whatever they paid him, he probably thought, oh, I'll take the money and run. And if
I really think he thought no one was ever going to see it, so he's like, oh, forget it, I'll do whatever.
He's one of the few people on this cast list that never appeared in any of the sequels. I don't think Michael Emerson did either. But you see a lot of Dina Meyer in the future movies, and like I say, Elway comes back, Winnell in one way or another is back. I don't think we'll see Monica Potter ever again, but you don't really need to. You know that actress, pretty good one at this year, only made 13 movies ever. Her last one was, I'll say this again, but it was the remake this time, The Last House on the Left, 2009. It's been 10 years since she made a film. She does TV quite a bit now. A lot of people do that. The resume's entirely TV. Michael Emerson hasn't made a movie in 11 years, but he did Lost and then Person of Interest, and I guess he just does TV type stuff all
and
the time.
And he's a bona fide TV star. People love him, as they should. He's great.
Ken Leung does mostly TV too, hasn't really made that many movies. One thing about Monica Potter I'll mention is that her wrists, I noticed this, are discolored early on before she's supposed to be tied up. And I wonder if they shot the bondage scene first or if maybe the Gordons are kinky.
No, I think...
They're not having sex, so...
It doesn't even look like bruising. It looks like makeup. Because she gets herself free of the ropes, and then you see that her wrists
are
red.
I pointed out to you when we first see her comforting the daughter.
When you see her with the daughter, it's red like makeup. It's not
proper bruising. Because she hasn't been put in bondage yet. Hasn't been put in there...
Because they shot that scene after the first scene, and they didn't wash her makeup off, and they didn't have time to...
Move it fast!
Yes.
Move it on!
You were totally right the first time. You're just like, they shot those scenes out of order, and nobody noticed that she still had that makeup on her wrist.
I think it could have actually been bruising from when they shot it, and it just wasn't
covered
up very
well.
It
doesn't look like bruising
to me. Okay. Also, no women die in this film. It's only guys.
Well, that's unusual for
the sequels, there's plenty of women, and there's also no last girl that survives this. It's a last boy who doesn't survive. It's game over, as he just, I guess, dies of thirst a few days in that.
Oh, that's awful. Well, he wouldn't die of thirst. There's water in that bathroom, I guess.
He could drink the toilet water. Ugh. Dig through the shit in that toilet.
There's the tub.
Yeah.
Must have running water.
I'm just pointing out that there's that disgusting toilet.
It is disgusting. And I said when he was reaching the toilet, why wouldn't he check the back of the toilet first? And then, of course, it was in the back of the toilet. And he says that.
Well, he even has that same line.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess this movie started with that pitch idea between Winnell and Juan, which is, what if two guys were stuck in a bathroom with a corpse between them? The most disgusting bathroom in the world, in fact. Much like Trainspotting. That was the way it was described in that script.
The worst
in
toilet in Scotland.
Right. So start with that premise, and where do we go from there? So I mentioned that Juan shot two Insidious movies, two Conjuring films, Aquaman, also Furious 7. The guy's a mogul at this point. But this was a fast shoot. You point out there's very few wide shots or establishing shots, but even the blocking of that, it looks sometimes like Jigsaw in the middle of the room is a long way away from them. But some of the other shots, it looks like they could reach out and touch him.
That's just a matter of using one lens or another, I think. And they probably actually shot that in a room so they couldn't get the camera far enough back to get an establishing shot, which I miss. You don't really get a spatial understanding, and it's just the room.
Right.
This is something they used to great effect in the movie Room, where you never see the whole room. You
but they had flyaway
see
sets.
This corner, that corner.
Flyaway walls in that movie. So
okay, would... fine, until the very end of the film when you actually see the whole room, and you see how small it actually was, but it's kind of a trick that they show it in this way to give it this enormous space, because to the kid, it's his whole world.
Yeah.
So it feels like the space is all these nooks and crannies until he's actually seen the real world and he goes back and sees how small it actually is. That is a case of this technique having a great effect, whereas in Saw, I was desperate for an establishing shot.
You do see one way onto the film. It kept
you see
establishing.
It with the security footage as well. And it's a fisheye lens, which is why they can get an extreme fisheye lens, which is why they can get the whole room in that shot.
So that sets it up. But that's also, what, 25, 30 minutes into the movie, maybe even longer into the movie. The producers were Greg Hoffman, Oren Cools, who worked on all the sequels, and Mark Berg, who worked on the sequels. And also Bull Durham, he was involved in that one way back when. Hoffman is credited on all the Saws, but died in 2005. So I guess just because he's part of this trio, they said, oh, we'll give credit to the guy. Maybe it means his family, his wife, whatever, gets money she wouldn't have gotten. I don't know how that works exactly. But these guys did make all of the sequels, and they mostly succeeded because even though they started not making as much money as you got further along, they cost nothing. And if they made even $40 million or $20 million, they still were relatively profitable. Bad as the hiccups. The movie's 185-1. We watched it on demand and had to pay for it. Boo. Cinematographer David Armstrong, he didn't like his work, shot the first six movies. The editor, Kevin Grutert, he edited four more Saw movies after this, and then directed six in 3D. And he relies on so many fast cuts. I'll give you a chance to talk about that in 1 second. But first, the music composer was Charlie Klauser, who worked on every single Saw movie. And we've had some iconic themes. Yeah, I know you didn't like the music in Nightmare or Texas Chainsaw. It's not really music in Texas Chainsaw. Right, we talked about that. Not music, per se. Sound effects. The music score required air quotes. It wasn't really a music score. But Nightmare on Elm Street has pretty famous music. Vampire you didn't like, I know, last week. And of course, dun-dun-dun, dun-dun-dun, dun-dun-dun-dun, dun-dun-dun. In this movie, they use it in all the movies. So what'd you think of the look? You said you hated that. The cutting, and I guess you didn't like the music.
The cutting I'm going to give a pass to because this movie was made in 2004 and they're heavily borrowing from music videos that were popular at the time. Oh. You see the scenes where they do the extra fast and it's distorted. They speed it up so much and it just looks like madness. He's just dead-ass copying Floria Sigismundi, who you know who that is, right?
Nope.
She's a film director now, but she was a rather famous music video director and she directed a lot of heavy metal music videos, most notably Marilyn Manson videos. I'm just super into that stuff, so I can tell you that that is a direct pull from those. Maybe doesn't age very well, but at the time, probably looked really cool and had a different cultural touchstone than it has now in 2019. it was the touchstone of heavy metal music videos.
So you thought the editing was pretty good then?
If I was in that edit suite, I would have cut this film down to like 40 minutes.
What about the da-da-dun? Horror movie score. We've talked about this in other horror movies before. I think you gotta cut some slack.
The best horror movies to me don't have score. They have ambience, like Texas Chainsaw, like, oh my god, that's who the best horror film director is. It's David Lynch. How did I not think of
not
that?
Not only horror films, though.
He scares me more than anybody. No films scare me.
I don't think
David
you would call
Lynch
those
movies.
Horror films.
Okay, fine.
If well, you include him, then maybe
he scares
the
wits out of me.
Oh, if you include him in the horror film directors, if that was what you could do, then okay, he'd be definitely in the top five, if not number one.
His scores, which are more like ambient noise, there you have a horror film, or at least something that's scary that isn't necessarily using music, but it is kind of a shortcut. It's a little bit cheap.
Yeah.
It just doesn't get under my skin. It'll give me a jump scare, but it doesn't scare me the way a more creepy ambient soundtrack does.
So we've talked about a lot of the connections. The seven sequels, the Hostel films are certainly related to this, although they got more bloody than this. I think also this is reverse of The Sixth Sense, where John Kramer, Jigsaw, was alive the whole time, not a ghost, like Bruce Willis was a ghost the whole time. And that was a good twist, even though it doesn't really hold up. Saw was released the same year as Passion of the Christ and Dawn of the Dead. And as much as this movie has a reputation of being bloody and violent and over the top, those movies are way more bloody and
good
violent
point.
And over the top. I like them both a lot. I would actually rather watch either one of those, although Passion of the Christ is one of those you only watch once in a long while because it is so hard to watch. Dawn of the Dead is actually pretty entertaining, but holy fuck, is it... Well, it should be. I guess it's a zombie movie. It is so gory. So what happens next? Well, we know there's sequels. When I invented this What Happens Next idea about 2 months ago, it applied more to movies like Whiplash. They don't have any sequels. But we know that Dr. Gordon survives, Adam dies, and then Jigsaw plays a lot more games but dies at the end of the third film. I'm not sure what there is to say about What Happens Next because there's so many movies that actually address that. We'll get back to that more when we get away from sequels about what could happen next. That's supposed to be a fun thing, almost like a nutshell. Doesn't really apply here. So let's move
what
on.
What happens to Allison and her daughter?
Yeah, especially when her husband becomes part of this crazy shit. Does he hide that? Does he have time to do all that and then still be an oncologist?
Because his affair is kind of to blame for them getting targeted by this murderer.
I did not cheat on her!
That's going to be the end of their already on thin ice marriage. Mm-hmm. And they're just going to move to a different state.
He does love his daughter. I like the sequence when he's typing away. And he's working. He's got a job where he's working all the time, even at home. And he says, I can't really deal with the daughter right now. And Allison's mad at him for that. But it's seconds later. Okay, bang, bang, bang. Save my computer. Okay, what's up? I like that touch. And he's
loves,
there for
yeah,
his daughter.
Yeah,
and he's
really,
good with
really
her.
Does.
He's really good with her. And then you get the flip side of that because he's great with his daughter in that bedroom. And I think the next time you see that bedroom is when Michael Emerson is menacing her in probably the only real truly scary sequences, along with, I guess, the big masks. So last thoughts and a long podcast here on Saw.
Yeah, I really can't get behind this one. I think it comes down to just never feeling attached to any of the characters, their fear, their wish to live. It just doesn't come across. It's impossible for me to forgive its low-budget shortcomings.
I think it's a pretty good mystery. So many people have secrets that we find out as it goes along. And that ending sure shocked me that first time. Emerson's creepy. John and his brief screen time is pretty effective. Again, more so in the sequels when you see him more often, you know that he's mad, and he's also a judgmental fucking asshole. So with this, we end Scary Movie Month, but tune in to Scoring at the Movies on Thursday, because Chris and I are going to talk about Lionheart. Not for that so much, you should tune in. Well, you should tune into that, too. But we'll also spend some time highlighting our favorite horror flicks. So that'll be on Halloween itself, and that will be really the end of Scary Movie Month, because that'll be the last day of October, and the best day of the year. In 7 days, we'll duck TVs being thrown at our heads as we walk down the stairs, as we talk about Precious, the movie that made us believe that Mariah Carey and Monique have acting talent. And in that movie, they sure did. The coming attractions trivia for Precious, based on a novel pushed by Sapphire. Oscars for writing, either adapted or original screenplays, have been won by black men on 5 occasions. How many of those guys didn't also direct those films?
For the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast about Precious, based by the novel Pushed by Sapphire. And in the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, where all of our over 300 episodes are available for free. That includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and/or 2007 lists of the best American films ever made. In exchange for all this great content, Perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review. That helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 20% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code top100project at checkout. That's all one word, top100project, and it's not case-sensitive.
You have to end this podcast. Those are the rules.
And cut.